White Area and Resistance calling. White Area and Resistance calling. This is White Area and Resistance, and this is Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger, right here in the bunker in North Central Indiana on December the 16th, 2014, Tears Day. That's right. And we got a half moon still. How about that? And it's rainy, been rainy for 2 days. Well, it's always good to have plenty of water. Plenty of water in the ground, and crops are almost all in and the whole bit. So everything's going pretty good here, except it's a dismal, dank, damp day. And I might have known something was going to go to hell today because I did a whole hour show, including all the reading of the rest of the Exiles from History and a couple of other things, and got right down to the end. I had about 3 or 4 minutes left to do on the show, and some interference from another program came on and wiped the whole thing out. Now normally I can find it, but this didn't even finish the recording, and so it's not there. So I got to do the whole damn thing again. So if I cuss more today than I usually do, well, you'll know why. So here we go back with Exiles from History. Remember, boys and girls, who's your daddy? Well, no, who knows? Maybe it'll sound better this time. We go to the chapter on why. Jews are without a doubt the most literary and prolific publishers in the world. Indeed, they have been called the people of the book. Besides owning and controlling large sections of the commercial book, newspaper, and magazine publishing world, their ethnic publications by far outstripped those of any other racial or religious group in America. Even the Communist Party USA has a special publication for the Jews, Jewish Affairs, a privilege not accorded to much larger minority groups, such as Negroes or Irish Americans. Probably the most respectable Jewish publication is the monthly Commentary, whose editor at the time, Norman Podhoretz, was one of those Jews who switched from a leftist to a neocon when some naive folk started trying to apply humanitarian values to Israel's naked imperialism and colonialism. The values that Jewish radicals busily advocated in regard to the U.S. policy in Vietnam suddenly became absolutist and sentimental when applied to the Jewish statelet. The better-known Jewish publications like Commentary are consequently those which are accessible to non-Jews. Editorials and position papers are written in flowery, urbane, if somewhat sturgeon style. They will take a dozen pages to arrive at a single point in the last paragraph, which more often than not will ask, "Is it good for the Jews?" Once in a while, a Jewish writer will acknowledge this ethnocentric position. What's going on here? Not another problem. What the hell? Better-known Jewish publications like Commentary are consequently those that are accessible to non-Jews. Editorials and position papers are written in flowery, urbane, if somewhat turgid style. They will take a dozen pages to arrive at a single point in the last paragraph, which, more often than not, will ask, "Is it good for the Jews?" I did that over again because I don't know what the hell was going on there, snapping and crackling. This is turning out to be my day! Once in a while, a Jewish writer will acknowledge this ethnocentric position in more personal terms. In Newsweek magazine of 15 September 1980, Joseph Eger wrote, "Survival was the big and only question in my family when I was growing up. Economic survival and survival of the Jews as a people. My grandmother judged all by strictly family affairs, by one criterion. Is it good for the Jews?" Eger also described how his family cut off and declared as dead his sister, who married a goyim non-Jew. They even recited the rights of the dead on her behalf. And, quote, she obediently died a few years later of colitis, which many psychologists connect with repressed grief and anger. We have already noted in our Odyssey about the tomes and tombs of Judaica that anal fixations do indeed seem to have greater frequency among Jews than among non-Jews. Whether that fixation emerges as colitis, cancer of the colon, chronic constipation, obsessions with toilet jokes or abuse, excretory nightmares, whatever particular manifestation, the root cause remains the same. Jewish guilt and self-hate brought about by punitive childhood seems to be at the bottom of all of it. We're immediately reminded of the oft-told Jewish joke where the Jewish mother is telling her son, quote, eat your chicken soup. You'll need strength to worry, unquote. Humor is, of course, the synthesis of much streetwise knowledge of many social phenomena. Put simply, ethnic jokes would fall flat on their face if there was no grain of truth within them. Jewish jokes told in North Dakota would probably have little impact because there would be such a meager database for the listener to draw upon. But a Jewish joke told in New Jersey would be the hit of the evening on account of the listener's intimate familiarity with Jewish culture and lifestyle. Of course, Jewish humor is oftentimes only permissible when it's presented by Jewish comedians. Anyone else who takes the liberty of lampooning Jewish values is liable, in fact destined, to be labeled as their social leper and anti-Semite. The more specific, more ethnic Jewish publications also give a better insight into the Jewish outlook. The Jewish Press of Brooklyn is probably the largest circulation of all strict Jewish newspapers, although there are ultra-Orthodox publications and groups beyond it. I'll point out one thing. I used to subscribe to that paper, and I did, and in the notices of death notices in the paper, almost every Jew mentioned said the name and then otherwise known. They almost all had AK. AKA. So what that meant to me was these were all these people who came into the United States and they said, they claimed they were all gassed and cremated, but they come in here through Mexico and Canada and all kinds of other ways and use a different name. I never heard many people talking about that. I don't know whether they still do it today. If you get a copy of that paper, go back to the obituaries and that's what you'll find. What other reason would be they have another name? No, it's a typical sneaky Jew deal. The more specific, more ethnic Jewish publications also give a better insight into the Jewish outlook. The Jewish Press of Brooklyn is probably the largest circulation one. I read that. Regular features like Ask the Rabbi explore debates on the observation of the tiniest details of Jewish ritual law and the regulation of Jewish life. I guess that's the same as a Christian talking about how many angels can sit on the head of a pin. News features about this or that aspect of U.S. relations with Israel are full of punitive expressions like rebuke, chastise, slap in the face, wrath, and penance. Nowhere can one find the slightest manifestation of joy, happiness, nature, or love. Rarely does America get any appreciation at all. The American government is the subject of continuous complaint. Okay, here. Next page. Hold on. Invective. The Israeli government, especially the more chauvinistic wing, that's the current president, is the recipient of great praise. Nitwit. I call him Nitwit. Yeah. Netanyahu, Premier Nitwit. Psychohistorian Howard F. Stein has written extensively on the nature of this Jewish obsession with brooding in his article, Judaism and Group Fantasy of Martyrdom, which appeared in the Journal of Psychohistory, Fall 78. He pointed out that a favorite Jewish expression is, Der Olam is a golem. The universe is a monster, unquote. The world is experienced as a heartless, mechanical monster that may strike you down at any time. There's a Nazi around every corner. The golem is a creature Jews created to protect them, but which then menacingly turned on them and threatened and continues to threaten to destroy them. There's a good movie about that. It came out in the 20s. It's a silent movie about the golem. That's funny. One needs only evoke the modern literary imagery of Franz Kafka's castle, the penal colony, the trial, the burrow, and the metamorphosis to know that you have to bear with me, boys and girls. I didn't go to college. Okay, to know that the golem still reigns unchallenged. And I hated English in high school. Jeez. Well, diagramming sentences and stuff. I'd rather eat glass. Only the characters and settings are different. The Jewish script is the same as it has been for a millennia. Trials, endless judgments, judges, painful punishments, death and execution. They're coming. They're after me. Spread the word, Jaime. Quote, the unfolding to the golem drama is an unearthing of what Jews fear they might become, and perhaps have become to their own people. Yeah, the fear, well, they do. They oppress their own people. There's no doubt about that. There's plenty of evidence to that. The fear of the golem is the Jew's fear of himself, of his own projected unbridled rage. The legend of the golem teaches Jews what not to become. You know, I just wonder whether there's anything to that they took it from Frankenstein, or Frankenstein was taken from the golem. That's an interesting question. The legend of the golem teaches Jews not what to become, while projectively, of course, reminding them of who they in fact are and fear to become. Like God, the golem is supposed to bring life. Instead, he is nothing but God in another of his guises, the angel of death, unquote. Stein reveals that even in the heights of enjoyment, Jews are still not free of the shadows of their own obsession with death. The well-known toast to life is only for stage shows like Fiddler on the Roof, it seems. There's a second toast, which undoes the first, a toast to death, which is never uttered. As Stein comments, quote, the historic Jewish covenant with death is far stronger and more enduring than with life. The language of death is spoken unconsciously, unofficially. Its toast is one of the depressive self-punishments and ultimately self-destruction. The chosen people have chosen themselves for sacrifice, suffering, martyrdom, persecution, victimization. At the close of his novel, The Family Mascot, written before the Holocaust, Isaac Bashevis, Singer, pens the terrible truth that death is the Messiah. Okay. Stein also gives us yet more examples of wouldn't we have guessed, Jews being burnt alive, wrapped in their own Torah. In Roman times, the study of the Torah had been prohibited on penalty of death. The venerated Rabbi Hananiah ben Tradon and his students were caught by Roman legionnaires in the act of secretly studying the Torah in a cave. According to legend, Rabbi Hananiah was wrapped in the sacred scrolls and burned alive. You know, it's my understanding that the scrolls were only about the size of this book page I'm reading off of. You'd have to take quite a few pages to wrap a whole body. Maybe they did. During my early Hebrew education, he was invoked by countless teachers and rabbis as perhaps the quintessence of Jewish loyalty and valor. I remembered hearing as a child the grueling story of Rabbi Amnon of medieval Mainz, Germany. Living during times of forced conversion to Catholicism. Rabbi Amnon was a devout Jew who refused to capitulate. Now you see where all this comes down to, religious war. And the Catholics heated up the war, and that's the way it went back and forth. Sometimes they love the Jews, sometimes they hate the Jews. But believe me, the Jews always hate us, I think. The archbishop made one final attempt to convert him and failing, ordered that the rabbi's hands and legs be severed as an example to other stubborn Jews. Years later, I was told that Rabbi Amnon probably never existed, nor did the events happen that way. Stein does not discuss whether the Nazi immolation and torturing of Jews might not be equally soundly based on yarns about Rabbi Hananiah and Amnon, but he does provide us with a remarkable insight into the mentality that would create such a scenario. Mark Zabrowski has elegantly documented how the Jewish experience of illness and pain expresses dominant Jewish preoccupations. One is anxiously future-oriented about the outcome of the disease. One's current doctor really did not cure the disease at all. Feeling good, healthy, is only temporary. Relapse is bound to occur. The future is bleak, just as illness is chronic. Life itself is a fatal disease. It is only a matter of time. In a letter written to me several months ago, a Jewish literary colleague expressed the same thing, though in humorous admonition. I think, actually, that I am down because I've been up for too long. It is not good for a psyche to be up too long. You begin to feel arrogant about your place in the world. And you know, and I know, that this will never do for us Jews. It's in the blood to come down when you've been up for quite a while. One should not feel too good, too competent, too secure. It just isn't Jewish. The solution is self-construction, self-doubt, a depressive, self-punitive, self-castrating, making oneself, incidentally, into the stereotypical, stooped-over, invisible little Jew whose male dominion consists of the ritualized confines of the Talmudic scholasticism. There are no small errors. To err in the slightest is to bring upon oneself ridicule, severe reprimand, a censure from the teachers, and from an anxiously performing classroom of sibling rivals, all competing for the taskmaster's favoritism and protection from further ridicule. To survive, one must be compulsively perfectionist while fomenting its opposite, a real towards authority and a wish for vengeance on the exactor of tribute, mother, father, teacher, rabbi, God. And an exodus into the instinctual freedom. The latter, of course, generates guilt and fear of punishment. So that one becomes his own severe moral judge, exacting from and suppressing in others what one forbids in himself. Wow. Now we are getting closer still to the kernel of Dr. Stein's brilliant essay. The infliction of guilt upon Jewish children by their parents causes them to become self-hating. Okay, next page. Whatever they do is not enough. No matter how successful, how wealthy, how smart, never is it enough to conquer the genetic Jewish fatalism. Always there is a knot of fear that just around the corner is yet another Holocaust. A bunch of Nazis waiting around the corner. Always there is an even deeper fear of perhaps Jews deserve Holocausting. Always there is the dread that within one's Jewish self there is a schlemiel, a fool whom the Gentiles will take advantage of, a part of one's, if that parent mirrors to him the warning him not to become. That's a little disjointed, isn't it? How do Jews act out these internal psychological forces? We have seen in the preceding chapters that the Jewish self-hate can manifest itself in many different forms. It will almost surely exhibit what are almost psychosomatic characteristics. In that, self-hating Jews almost invariably have hang-ups in their sexual and anal functions. Ugh. Karl Marx was forever going on about shit and crap in his correspondence with Engels. Freud seemed to be unable to think in any other terms. Modern humanistic psychologists seem to have a thing about sexual and toiletry terms of abuse. Many Holocaust survivors and exterminationists seem to harp about these such matters in their testimony. Many of the Jewish personalities we have studied have suffered often terminal ailments in these areas. Self-hating Jews also frequently dwell on the symbolism of self-destruction. They will conjure up the imaginary Dante's Inferno, where Jews are burned alive with or without Torah scrolls, by Romans, by medieval Germans, by Nazi Germans, and by Palestinians. Jews are torn apart by dogs or rats or by more Germans. Always the fear and anxiety of brutal destruction hangs like a shadow over Jewish life. In reaction, Jews exhibit neurotic behavior patterns. Male Jewish babies are mutilated in a weird primitive ritual known as circumcision, which surely exists as a token castration. Brooding over their own sense of inadequacy, Jewish fathers vicariously and tokenly castrate their own sons, perhaps because they wish they could chop off their own penises. Or perhaps they mechanically react to their parents dumping on them by passing on all the neurosis onto their own children. What better way could there be to start off a live neurosis than to mutilate a tiny baby's penis without the benefit of an anesthetic in the middle of a crowd of spectators where the castrator ritually gives the baby a blowjob? Then there are Jews who go overboard in seeking to deny their own origins. They are so full of self-hate and sense of personal inadequacy that they will change their name, change their religion, change their noses, change their hair, change their friends, change their lifestyle, change their boobs. Wait, that's not in there. All in a mad scramble to appear Jewish. Some, like Karl Marx, will make a special point of overcompensating and will deride that ridiculous every little Jew who crosses his path, often in the most outrageous way. Remember, Marx was a strange anti-Semite, if you'll read his stuff, A World Without Jews. Marx had not a word to say about the immensely powerful Jewish banking dynasties such as the Rothschilds. Then we have Trotsky, who changed his name, but otherwise stuck pretty hard and fast to traditional Jewish pattern of ambition and power-seeking. Most of the modern Jewish radicals, especially those of the 1950s and 60s, would fit into this mold, although on the surface they might be perceived as trying to pass. Not very far underneath one will find all the compensatory chauvinism that less radical Jews openly display. As Stein pointed out earlier, this kind of Jew is projecting his hatred and resentment of parental rabbinical authority against the establishment. But always this rebellion is laced with guilt, and the Jewish radical becomes his own severe moral judge. exacting from and suppressing in other what one forbids in oneself. The Yippie movement of the 60s, which was almost totally Jewish-led, illustrates this perfectly. Anyone the age of 30 was derided and hated, anyone over the age of 30. Jewish radicals were enlisting and bamboozling thousands of gullible Gentile youngsters into acting out their own Jewish anxieties and neuroses. Not all passers are radical, of course. The world of politics, show business, and commerce are strewn with an example of Jewish name changers who somehow think that adopting an Anglo-Saxon moniker will advance their careers. In this case, the names are changed not so much as an attempt to deny one's own Jewish identity, but to try and hide it from the Gentiles' querulous gaze. If Jews start to make themselves too obvious, and if the Gentile starts counting up just how many Jews are in position of power, well, you just never know how they might react. And that's why I think it's great that we're getting more and more Jews running for office, and Jews in Congress, Jews in the Senate. The more they come out like that, the more at least a certain amount of non-Jews will understand them completely. And indeed, will privately support Jewish causes and even attend synagogue once in a while. In Hollywood, there's a kind of party game played which revolves around is he or isn't he, where partiers exchange tidbits of background information to determine which star is one of us. A variation to the Jew who tries to pass as Portnoy's type. The Philip Roth novel Portnoy's Complaint describes what happens to the Jew who tries ever so hard to pass and then fails. Portnoy seeks to integrate into WASP society, sleep with the most Aryan WASP women, do WASP things, and hope that some, if not all, the WASPishness will rub off on him. There was nothing Portnoy would have loved better than to have had the blue blood flowing through his Jewish veins. When he finds out that it doesn't quite work that way, he turns bitter and resentful, and his original envy turns to hate. Although the 100% Portnoy character is a rarity in everyday non-fictional world, we can still detect aspects of his complaint woven amongst other Jewish behavior patterns. But of course, the most common typical Jewish manifestation of Jewish anxieties is pushy, ambitious, aggressive, manipulative Jew who readily admits his Jewishness and seeks to fulfill Mama's dreams by always trying harder. This, too, is a form of self-hate, because as Dr. Stein indicates, whatever one does, it is never enough. High achievement is still inadequate achievement. Mama and all the others have drummed into their Jewish sons that no matter what, you have to get out there and work night and day, take work home with you, worry about your sleep, for if a Jew starts to slip and loses his social function, position of importance and power, then when the next Holocaust comes, pow! Jews must always be on the lookout for anti-Semitism. Around every corner, stormtroopers too, under every rock, Jews must negotiate themselves into positions of influence. No, not obvious positions of influence like president or TV news anchormen, but backroom positions like the presidential advisors, news editors, and whatever. It's not a question of if the next Holocaust will come, but when, and Jews must be ready for it. Well, since this book is written back in late 70s, early 80s, things have changed a lot. They're coming out of the woodwork, coming out of the closet, and they're going for higher positions. I mean, we've even had a couple of them, didn't they run in the primaries for president? Anyhow, they're up there. Many Jews are, of course, aware of these symptoms. few actually deal with them on an objective basis. Even those in psychology industry seemingly avoid to face up to such questions by simply universalizing their fears and anxieties and projecting them onto non-Jews. As we have discovered in an earlier chapter, psychotherapy appears largely to be a program of Jews telling Gentiles that they suffer from Jewish problems. Fortunately, not all are afflicted with this tunnel vision. Again, we defer to Dr. Howard Stein's superb article, where he concludes, quote, Auschwitz does not stand alone as one grim event, but is a metaphor for Jewish history itself. Holocaust is the meaning of Jewish history. The price of Jewish history is the enactment of a group fantasy in a martyr role, which has made a variety of varieties of dying a way of life. For Jews do not alone passively find themselves in that world, but also employ it to make victims of them. The world of social reality is coerced into confirming the Jewish group fantasy of history. The ultimate lesson of the Jewish history is that peace will never be attained until the Jews can relinquish their grim and lachrymose fascination with the millennia of Auschwitzism. Until they can let go of the self-destruction fantasy that is the very substance of Jewish identity. Jews cannot escape Jewish history by trying not to be Jews, only by not having to live by or live out the group fantasy or martyr victim will the Jews be able to psychohistorically to ascend Jewish history. Perhaps then Jews will not have to escape from history at all, and will no longer need to fashion idols in the wilderness to redeem them. For no longer self-imposed exiles from history, erstwhile wandering Jews will have found a homeland rooted in the only secure home this world can offer in themselves and thereby in life. Dr. Stein was indeed described the only possible final solution to the Jewish problem. Only through the Jews regaining their own self-esteem will they be at peace. Continuation of Jewish anxiety and low self-esteem can only mean, as we have seen, a continuation of the Jewish bunker mentality, where every non-Jew is seen as an enemy or potential enemy. It can only mean a continuation of quack therapy cults, where the Jews try to purge themselves of neurosis by projecting them onto others and insisting that it is the non-Jew and not the Jew who suffers from such anxieties. In fact, like I said yesterday, it was mainly the Jews themselves that turned me into being anti-Jew or anti-Zionist or whatever you want to call it. Because the more I read about international banking, I kept seeing these Jew names, and when I started mentioning it to people around me, and if there were any Jews, as there were some Jews in the John Birch Society, they jumped all over me, and I couldn't figure it out. Well, why are you jumping all over me? So what? Is it a fact? If these guys are the heads of big banks? I named other non-Jews. Nobody got excited. So they gradually pushed me somewhat into my position now. That's right. Incidentally, we had a guy in the Birch Society in Southern California back then who got the prestigious award from Robert Welch of the John Birch Society. And his first name was Eddie, I think. He was a real ugly Jew. The biggest hook nose you ever want to see. And he was in the John Birch Society, and they paraded him all over California and the nation and gave him this big award, put him through college, I think. I think he's still around. I think I saw his name someplace, but I can't remember his last name right now. But if you look back in the 60s, you'll find his name somewhere in relation to the John Birch Society, because I think he wrote a couple of books, too. He was a weird mother. The development of psychohistory by Dr. Stein and his colleagues is truly one of the most encouraging phenomena to arrive on the academic scene in decades. Let us hope that the exiles from history do not retreat into their psychological bunkers, and dismissing psychohistory with the most ironic projection of all, self-hate. I got a feeling I left out a page there. I'm not sure about that. I'll try to track it down. There you go. That's the end of it for today, and that's the end of the Exiles from History. And like I said, you probably would like to download one from our website, because it's good to photocopy and give to people. I photocopy different chapters and send them around to people, and a lot of the POWs that need something to read. Here's another subject we should be concerned with, females of our race, and males too, as far as breast cancer is concerned. Breast cancer levels are way higher in white women. What feminist lifestyle has brought to them? Well, that's for sure. Age-adjusted incidence per 100,000 of breast cancer from 1998 to 2002 is highest in white women, 141, followed by African women, 119.4, Asian American, 96.6, and Latin American, 89.9, with the lowest incidence in the indigenous American women, 54.8. I guess they mean the Mongol Indians or something. Well, it's probably got a lot to do with this breast enlargements all the women, a lot of the women have gotten into. It looks nice, but they've sold them the concept if you don't have big titties, you're not going to get a man. I've seen pictures of some women have gone crazy, absolutely crazy, and got giant knockers, and boy, I'll tell you, I don't think that's very good for you. But that came out of the Jewish, feminist concepts to get women doing things that are very detrimental to their health, like high heels. I'll bet you anything a Jew came up with high heels. I see them quite a bit, and God almighty, they're like four inches in the back. And they're walking around like that. That gave an invention to the chiropractors. I mean, these women are in these chiropractors all the time because they tend to wear these high-heeled shoes instead of flat shoes. Like I even find it on some shoes for men that are a little bit higher, and they don't make your back feel good. So I try to wear flat out, like almost moccasins as much as possible, except in the winter time. Well, there's a new book coming out right here around Hanukkah from Mosaic Books. I'm sure it's a Jewish outfit. Menachem Begin's Zionist Legacy. Just in time for Hanukkah, it says. This collection of brilliant and never-before-published essays by six of the most perceptive observers of Jewish and American life gives fresh insight into the personal, political, religious character of one of Israel's biggest assholes, a totally evil man. He even looks evil. And Begin's unabashed, unapologetic commitment to his people before any others. Isn't that just what I told you? Yeah. Let me see here if there's any more of this. Misunderstood relationship between Begin and his mentor Zev Zebaktinsky, and why Begin was detested by his rival David Ben-Gurion. You know, David Ben-Gurion was a Buddhist, I believe, one of those Asian religions. And then it kind of has the true role of Jimmy Carter in the process leading up to Camp David Accord. You know, Jimmy Carter, his Christian approach is so funny. I mean, it shouldn't be funny. It should be sad, because he should have been a preacher and not a president. But however, he does have the guts to take on leaders of Israel. Actually, it's fair way, but they don't respect fairness. You know that. That's just what I read to you. You're either with them or totally against them. Yeah. So anyhow, this guy, Begin, was a terrorist, and he terrorized King David Hotel and blew up all those British people that were staying there, 200 of them, I believe. And yet the United States, while he was alive and head of Israel, kissed his ass every step of the way. And so did Britain. Until you grab these people by the nape of their neck and say, this is not the way it's going to be, or else, they could continue to do what they do. And then they'll cry, oh, my God, you hate us. You hate us. I only tried to kill you. Why are you reacting against me so badly, Goyim? Well, I'm not going to run out and get this book. It's going to be a bunch of bullshit just seeing how wonderful this terrorist was. If Brits had any guts, they'd have rounded up that Irgun and wiped him out. But we wouldn't want to be seen as anti-Semitic. I watched the blurb by on Jon Stewart's show, who's a Jew, I know, about this puppet master Dick Cheney, who is a Frankenstein, the most criminal guy yet of this century, that's for sure, that should have been lined up against the wall and shot after he's convicted. It shouldn't be that hard to convict a bastard. There's a little bit of that sort of confrontation.
Said about that before. This weekend, people all over the country came together to state unequivocally that even the most depraved violence is justified in the face of fear. Wait a minute, that's not them. That's no, those are protests against fear-based violence. Where's my excusing fear-based? There we go. Yes, the directors of the CIA, current and former, approached the bench and argued the pro case, rebutting the Senate Black Site Torture Prison Report. First up, former CIA Director Michael Hayden.
Three out of the last four attorneys general have defined this as not being torture. So let's get the legal definition off the table.
It's gone from the table! Three out of four. Our interrogation practices don't even make it to sugarless gum approval percentages. Yeah, I did the math on the fractions there. By the way, coincidentally, the three out of the four attorneys general all, I'm sure it's a coincidence, happen to be President George W. Bush's attorneys general. So if you want an even stronger statistic, you could say 100% of attorneys general told to say whatever we did wasn't torture said that. Math. Current CIA Director Brennan.
I certainly agree that there were times when CIA officers exceeded the policy guidance that was given, but we are not a perfect institution.
Do not judge, lest ye be judged. For let he who has never shoved a tube of pureed hummus up a man's arse cast the first stone. What is wrong with these guys? It feels like they're introducing even the smallest hint of nuance to this conversation. I never thought I'd see those two giving aid and comfort to the enemy. Perhaps it's time for an American to defend the program. One of our nation's founding fathers. Y'all ready for this? And now, stepping into the ring, a 5'8", two-time vice president, multiple-time draft deferee, hailing from an undisclosed location, the man so mean, his own heart ran away. The dark curtain from Halliburton, the Iraq blaster from Casper, the presidential puppet master, more machine than man, Dick the Dick Cheney.
You said earlier this week, torture was something that was very carefully avoided. It implies that you have a definition of what torture is. What is it?
Well, torture to me, Chuck, is an American citizen on his cell phone making a last call to his four young daughters shortly before he burns to death in the upper levels of the Trade Center in New York City on 9/11.
And that is why he is the best worst. Dick Cheney, setting this nation's moral bar at anything incrementally better than the most despicable thing that has ever been done to us. And by the way, that was out of the gate. That was the first question he was at. He had just met the press, and he opened with 9/11. That's like Leonard Skinner walking out and going, hey, why don't we just kick it off with a little Freebird? How about that? See if that can save you a little lighter fluid in your shouting voices there. Of course, the problem with doing that is you don't really give yourself anywhere else to go.
You won't call it torture.
I come back to the proposition. Torture was what the Al-Qaeda terrorists did to 3,000 Americans on 9/11. In my mind, I've told you what meets the definition of torture. It's what 19 guys armed with airline tickets and box cutters did to 3,000 Americans on 9/11.
Yeah, no, I see. That's just what meets the definition of torture in his mind. His mind, I assume, being the scariest place in the universe. You know what? I'm sorry. I know this is going to haunt my nightmares. I don't care. I got to know. Chuck, can we zoom inside Dick Cheney's mind?
But does that meet the definition of torture in your mind?
In my mind.
Never took him for a brony. Every time I think this man can't get more fascinating. So I guess we can test. Is Dick Cheney a righteous warrior or a psychopath? It's one thing to feel remorseless vengeance against those who have wronged us, which is why we've always been a nation that has followed the vigilantes code. I'm sorry, rule of law. Rule of law. But what if, hypothetically, this treatment was perpetrated on someone who had been detained wrongly? Surely that would soften Cheney's Bronson-like torture boner.
Let me go to Ghul Rahman. He was chained to the wall of his cell, doused with water, froze to death in CIA custody, and it turned out it was a case of mistaken identity. Dick?
Right. But the problem I have is with all the folks that we did release that end up back on the battlefield. I'm more concerned with bad guys who got out and released than I am with a few in fact, were innocent.
It's like this guy's the vice president in a Cormac McCarthy novel. Call it. Call it, friendo. Wah, wah. Call it, friendo. Wah. Heads. Wah. But look, perhaps we're being unfair. I'm not suggesting that Dick Cheney is using the terrible specter of what happened on 9/11 robotically as a cudgel to beat down argument, draining all emotion and meaning out of that terrible day as he uses it in service of avoiding culpability. Yeah, I'm not doing that. Cheney does feel upset. Cheney does feel hurt, angry even, at having to answer things.
When you say waterboarding is not torture, then why did we prosecute Japanese soldiers?
For a lot of stuff, not for waterboarding. They did an awful lot of other stuff. It's a really cheap shot, Chuck, to even try to draw a parallel.
Yeah, that's too far, Charles David Chuck Todd. That was a loaded question. You can't just pop up out of nowhere and shoot an old man in the face with a question like that. How dare you, Chuck Todd? At long last, why would you ask about decency? So with the moral controversy put to bed, let's focus on efficacy. The much-researched Senate CIA report suggests that the information could have, and in many cases was, obtained by different, more Geneva Convention-y, less butt-feedy methods.
It worked. It worked now for 13 years. It absolutely did work. I'd do it again in a minute.
Wouldn't give it a thought, man. And that, ladies and gentlemen, that's the best thing about Dick Cheney. He's impervious to doubt. Never enters his mind. Probably because all the little ponies run around up there, but... It never enters his mind that the confident, plain-spoken pronouncements of truth are oftentimes complete bull. Just from his appearances on Meet the Press.
That report that has been pretty well confirmed, that he did go to Prague and he did meet with a senior official of the Iraqi intelligence service.
And Saddam Hussein has a long-standing relationship with various terrorist groups, including the al-Qaeda organization. We believe he has, in fact, reconstituted nuclear weapons. He has been seeking to acquire the kinds of tubes that are necessary to build a centrifuge. This is a country that I think could be one of the leading, perhaps the leading state in that part of the world. My belief is we will, in fact, be greeted as liberators.
Guess what? They loved us so much, they wouldn't let us leave for over a decade. You know what? Just because he's bitter and angry doesn't mean I have to be. I'm going to end on a note of gratitude for something I never thought that I would say. George W. Bush, thank you for not dying while you were in office.
A terrible one. I just sent two books off to Matt Hale. I was surprised how cheap it was. I sent him a copy of The Crimson Prairie. Also, he indicated in a past letter that he was interested in learning German, so I sent him a book on that too. Neither book cost more than $5. I think it came to $11 total with shipping. I am certainly not a wealthy person, but our struggle might as well die the day we forget our POWs. I wonder how many right-wingers or clowns on the stormfront have even scrounged up 35 cents for a damn postcard with a line or two of encouragement to a prisoner. Right wing talks a good game, but when it comes to the wallet, you might as well ask for a brick wall. Tom, you seem to be one of the only racial activists who even mentions our POWs, let alone support them. Maybe they can think about that next time they go to buy a case of beer, a pack of smokes, or a new swastika tattoo, which I hope our people aren't doing anyway. You have their info posted up on resist.com. It's there for a reason. I only wish our cause wasn't compromised by the cheap bastards alive. I plan to continue writing to our guys, and when I send a book, I'm sure it's pretty much one of the only things they have look forward to. Lone Wolf. Signed, Lone Wolf. Okay, well, thanks for that, and I'm glad you're doing it. Just remember, when you send a book to a prisoner, if it's a hardbound book, and you can send hardbound books, but you got to rip the hard cover off. They will let them in without the hard cover on. So I've done that several times and no problem. In fact, the publishers, when you order them to be sent right to the prison, you just tell the publisher to take the cover off. They know all about it, because they do it all the time. Well, you got that right about the right wing. I'll tell you, the so-called racial cause, which I don't think there's much there, they never have supported to any degree POWs. I mean, if you got picked up for something, forget it. I mean, you're right wing. They're not going to help you out. And they're not, if you get convicted, they're not going to come and visit you. You know, like my son's over visiting David Tate right now, and later on I'm going down to see David Tate and Mahon, and I've been down to see Scutari when he was in Kentucky, but now he's down in Alabama, I think it is, and it's a little far for me to drive. The one thing I regret is I didn't get to see David Lane before he died, and he died just not too many miles from where I'm at, murdered by the federal government, which they put him on a plane, chained him all up, and transferred him to Indiana. When they knew his heart, he had a very bad heart, so as far as I'm concerned, the bastards murdered him. So anyhow. And there's been a whole bunch more guys that I've visited while they're POWs in the past. I'm not blowing my own horn, but I think that more people have to do it, but they don't do it. I'm just saying that they just don't do it, and that's what always leads me to believe that we're never going to go anyplace. Unless we don't change our ways. Even the lowliest nigger, rapist, torture, killer has people writing to them in prison, going to the prison, visiting them. They've even got support groups for the lowliest, rottenest, meanest nigger in town. But yet when white people trying to do something for the white race through violence get convicted, forget it. You're only going to have a handful of people supporting you. And so, and that's the same way when you say send a donation, and the guy says, "Well, I want revolution now. I want civil war now. Here's $2." I don't remember any revolution or civil war starting out with that kind of a bankroll. I'm going to comment here on something I sent up to American History X. Was in the news with a lot of people commenting, and I'm not going to try to do what I did before because that's how I lost the show, and I don't know how I lost the show, but I lost the show. So I'm going to comment now that a guy emailed me back. He said, "Are you really Tom Metzger?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, was this Derek that's in the movie, was he based on a real character?" And I said, "No, not to my knowledge." I told him about helping Tony Kaye put the movie together. In fact, I helped him on a documentary that he wanted to make. He wanted somebody to walk around with him a little bit. And it was on the BBC about who he was. He was an interesting Jew. He had license plates on his car, Super Jew, as he drove around Hollywood. And a lot of Jews didn't like him, that's for sure. But I warned him before the movie came out, I said, or when they were just starting to make it, I said, "Don't trust that New Line Cinema, they'll screw you." And he went ahead and he worked with New Line Cinema, and they did end up screwing him, and he had to sue him. I don't know how the lawsuit came out, but he probably didn't get anything. Another thing I said that Tony Kaye got totally incensed about was Edward Norton, who's a spoiled little brat actor. He got into the cutting room, editing room, and cut up the movie. In other words, cut parts out of it. And I said, "One thing good, I've got the original play. I mean, I've got the, what am I trying to say here? I've got the original transcript before Edward Norton got into the cutting room and cut it out. I don't know exactly what he cut out, but I'm sure it was some good stuff." Well, anyhow, Tony Kaye just went crazy about that because only a superstar has the ability to get into the cutting room. And almost no actor ever gets in the editing room. But here was this little pipsqueak. He got right in there real quick. Anyhow, you can read my whole statement when you go up there to this place on the web where they're talking about it. I'm sending it to you right now. Well, I'm happy to see that the Hammerskins got together to remember and eulogize Robert J. Matthews. Last week it says 36 racists gathered on Whidbey Island, Washington. We used to do that every year, but it got to be prohibitive sometimes about travel and plane tickets and stuff, to mark the 30th anniversary of the death of Robert J. Matthews, who founded a band of white supremacist terrorists intent on starting a race war. We've already got a race war. We had a race war before Bob Matthews ever came around. Anyhow, called the order. Members of the order had fled to the island after a gun battle days earlier with FBI agents at a motel in Portland, Oregon. Well, there was three at that hotel. I stayed at that motel in the same room that Bob Matthews stayed in. I've stayed in that several times. At the cabin, Matthews refused to surrender to the FBI, which later fired flares to burn him out and kill him. And that's okay. burning people alive. That's what our government does, real good job at burning people alive. You notice that? They do it all over the world. Burn them alive, burn them alive. And then they talk about the Nazis. Because of Matthew's unwillingness to surrender, he was widely regarded as a martyr. And he was a martyr. He is a martyr for white nationalists and racists who annually visit Whidbey Island as a part of a pilgrimage of sorts. This year was no different, attracting racists mostly from Northwest Hammerskins, considered one of the most violent skinhead groups in the country. Well, anyhow, that's I'm glad that happened. Nobody told me it happened.
Nobody told me. I didn't know nothing.
Well, that's it for the second time I've done this show today. There's a couple of things I left out because they were outtakes off the news that I, after I got done putting them on the first show, I erased them. So they're gone. Wasn't any big deal, but here we go. That's it for today. Watch out for Sneak and Peek. Yeah. They're out there. They want to come sneaking and peeking. Yeah. 14:05, and I'll be back with you tomorrow, and I think Sling Blade's going to be on here tomorrow, so we'll see what the hell he's got to say. Okay. Shut your pie hole. And let's say you're Lone Wolf Privateers. I like that. Lone Wolf Privateers.
Now you're ready to sail for the horn. Hey, roll and go. Our boots and our clothes, boys, are all in the horn. To be rollicking, randy, dandy, oh. Heave a port, oh, heave away. Hey, hey, roll and go. The anchor's on board and the cable's all scored. To be rollicking, randy, dandy, oh. Hey. Soon we'll be warping her out through the locks. Hey, hey, roll and go. For the pretty young girls all come down in their frocks. To be rollicking, randy, dandy, oh. Heave up, oh, heave away. Hey, hey, roll and go. The anchor's on board and the cable's all stored. To be rollicking, randy, dandy, oh. Come breast the bar